This is Ethics Talk from the AMA Journal of Ethics. This month, AMA Journal of Ethics theme editor Nikhil A. Patel, MS, a fourth-year medical student at the Mayo Medical School, interviewed Joya Mukherjee, MD, MPH, about Partners in Health's mission to strengthen low-income countries' healthcare systems and lessons learned from the Ebola crisis. Dr. Mukherjee is the chief medical officer of Partners in Health and an associate professor at Harvard Medical School and Brigham and Women's Hospital.
Where do you see the role of American physicians and medical students and other clinicians in this larger movement towards social justice?
Providing healthcare to the most vulnerable is part and parcel of how physicians play a role in social justice. If you go back to where I think the roots of social medicine really are, to Virchow, physicians are the natural lawyers for the poor. As physicians, we are bearing witness to people's suffering, and we see, without much analysis, that the suffering is very disproportionate among the poor. And the suffering is very rooted in the lack of the basic needs, food, shelter, access to healthcare, having a job. And so we need to be lawyers by collecting this evidence, putting it together in a story, and then advocating for greater justice. So I think physicians can play a very important role, not only in delivering care, but in performing the scholarship and the advocacy around the injustice that shows itself as health and healthcare disparities, but really is rooted in these deeper social injustices.
Have you seen any changes within the profession and how we work towards social justice?
Yeah, I think I have, Sunny. I feel in a way very optimistic about this, but we have a lot of work to do. And I'm fortunate to have been involved in the movement for HIV treatment access for over 20 years. It used to be that everyone who had AIDS died, but poor people, and especially poor people in resource-poor settings in Africa and elsewhere, died quicker. At the time that antiretroviral therapy was realized in 1996, 95% of the epidemic was in sub-Saharan Africa, and no one in that 95% was being treated. So the treatment access became the most gross and obvious injustice globally. And our group, Partners in Health, was involved in the first real feasibility study. We said, look, we can do it in rural Haiti. Even though people are poor, even though many people are illiterate, even though they have to travel great distances, they can take their medicines, they respond to it well, and they can go back to living a normal life. And while that paper, which was published in The Lancet in 2001, was scientifically not considered a good paper, the activists and the global community thought it was a phenomenal paper, because what they said is, wow, if you can do it in Haiti, we could do it in Bangkok. If you can do it in Haiti, we can do it in Soweto. If they can do it in Haiti, we can do it in Uganda. And it started to be part of a story to say, we have to make these drugs available. And that movement for many of us, and certainly for our organization, had little to do with AIDS. AIDS was an object lesson that if we can have a drug, a long-term therapy, laboratories, health clinics, physicians and nurses for one disease, why not have it for all diseases? Why not open that Pandora's box that had never really been opened to the entirety of the burden of disease and say, we actually owe it as a justice approach, as a human rights approach, to treat people for the illnesses they have. And so the story of AIDS became part of a real global movement for healthcare. It's not just about what we have the money to do today. When I was studying public health, the idea was countries have $5 per capita to spend. What can we do with that $5? But the pursuit of justice is very different. How ought we to alleviate suffering and understand what it will take to get to that alleviation of suffering? And then what resources do we need to get this done? And that movement created the Global Fund, which was the first international multilateral fund that would redistribute wealth from rich countries to poor countries for health. And now, today, more than 10 years after the start of the Global Fund, you can go to rural Mozambique and get your HIV treatment for free. In 1999, fewer than 50,000 people in sub-Saharan Africa were getting treatment, and none of them were being treated for free. Now there are almost 10 million people on the planet who are getting highly active antiretroviral therapy for free. The attention and energy and resources toward AIDS we could use to fight this larger battle for health justice.
How can we responsibly play a role in global health and health delivery?
First of all, we have to understand that our profession around the world is woefully underrepresented in the places with the highest burden of disease. So there are times and places that we are needed simply for our hands. And the Ebola crisis was one of the most obvious. But to achieve social justice is a group activity that is building a framework whereby local voices can have a say in understanding how best to deliver care in a resource-poor setting. And the collective action is really what's going to bring about social change.
What lessons have you learned from the Ebola virus disease in West Africa, and how can we use those lessons?
The first and most important lesson is that Ebola was never the problem. Ebola was a symptom of the fact that the health systems are so weak. Yes, we have to tackle Ebola because the suffering and death was really remarkable from one infection alone. And yet many more children are dying of malaria. Many more women are dying in childbirth. There's untreated tuberculosis, unmanaged HIV. So Ebola came as a canary in the coal mine of these very weak health systems, and we ought to use this epidemic as a wake-up call to say we must do better for countries like Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea, Mali. It's no coincidence that Nigeria, even though it doesn't have the strongest health system, was able to control the epidemic quickly because they at least have physicians and nurses and hospitals. There was a system. And the system did work. I think we ought to look at this as not only Ebola, but a real indictment of the system.
Where do you see the next steps in promoting global health equity?
One is a kind of expansion of the Global Fund. You might have heard it called the Robin Hood tax. The idea of the Robin Hood tax is some small tax on currency transaction that would be put in a multilateral fund. There's something called Unit Aid, which is a tax on airline travel by France, Brazil, and a handful of other countries that has been going to try to address some of the big challenges like drug-resistant TB. We've got to reform how American aid is done, which mostly goes to NGOs. Those NGOs are not coordinated well with governments. So we really want more money to go to the public sector and to have the public sector develop. There's another exciting piece of the movement, which is how can we make health available to people in a way that won't impoverish them? I think along with UHC, our job as implementers is to develop a set of metrics to show that we've achieved universal coverage. And we've developed some tools at Partners in Health that we're using in Lesotho to actually document that we have full coverage of facility-based delivery and full coverage of antiretroviral therapy. So we have to really say, what does universality look like? We've got to hold ourselves accountable for a better set of rules and guidelines by which we all work and support a common agenda.
We would like to thank Nikhila Patel and Dr. Joya Mukherjee for this month's podcast. The viewpoints expressed on this podcast are those of the interviewee and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of the AMA. To learn more about physicians' role in human rights in the October 2015 issue of the AMA Journal of Ethics, please visit www.amajournalofethics.org. You can also follow us on Twitter by searching @Journal of Ethics. This is Ethics Talk from the AMA Journal of Ethics.